again to continue something about last week's subject about conscience and bring it into relation with concepts of good and evil, right and wrong, and the will and desire. You remember that last week we defined conscience in a special way and related it to consciousness. The prefix con means with or together. The root SCI means to shear or cut. Hence you see it in the word scissors. The end at the end you could translate as essence or being. So you could say the being cut and put together is conscience. Consciousness itself is that whereby things are cut and put together and whereby we know what we have cut and put together. If we draw a circle to represent the totality of the experience of a being up to the moment we examine it, we know that it has eternity above it and enclosing it, and we know it has future time in front of it and past time behind it. When we draw this line, it symbolizes a limiting factor, because we draw the circle, it binds, it closes. The line goes round and closes on itself and thus insulates and isolates a zone for consideration. If we let this circle represent the totality of knowledge of a being up to the time of examining this being, we're dealing with an abstract concept, because at the moment of examining the being, we're interfering with the being and changing the totality of its knowledge. The thing is dynamic, so that when we start to consider conscience, we are changing conscience by considering it. Nonetheless, we represent the totality of knowledge at the moment of examination with the circle, and know that this circle should be considered to be expanding, simply because we are considering it and considering the content, and in the consideration of the internal content we are altering the distribution of forces and the relations within this circle. If we now start cutting the circle, this is the use of the root SCI, as if we got a pair of scissors and cut the circle down the centre, we now have two halves, and in cutting this circle we have given birth to a relationship that previously was implicit but not explicit, the relation enfolded into it that it can be considered as the two halves, right and left. Before we draw the line, that is not explicit, it is not folded out so that we can see it clearly. When we draw it in, we immediately make ourselves aware of the possibility of cutting this whole being with a pair of scissors. So we can write the SCI along that line. That is the cut. It enables us to analyze the totality of knowledge inside a being. Now, at the same time that it is analyzed, it is still circumscribed, because we are considering the sum total knowledge of a finite being. Total, it's dead. If there is a total, you come to the end of it, and it is therefore dead. The TOT means dead, and the DOD, the DD and the CT both mean dead. You find it in the modern German word for death, which shares the same form, and exactly the same idea is expressed in the two T's enclosing a space. It means that space is finited, and when you put all of that that is finited and duly crossed internally, carefully and clearly defined, that is a totality. That totality is an abstract, because the being is really growing and changing all the time. But for convenience, we can pretend that is a totality at the moment of analysis. But the binding circle round the cut halves is the meaning of the com prefix. Com is together, and it is this com that is running round and binding the two halves into a unity. So the SCI root is represented by the vertical line cutting the circle, and the perimeter of the circle represents con or with, binding the two halves together. Now the whole of this is a being, an entity, and therefore we have consience here. And as we can divide it vertically and talk about right and left, so we could divide it horizontally and talk about above and below. I got a bit higher up. Some people get long necks. If we divide down the centre vertically, we could write on one side the word dexter, borrowing a term from heraldry, and on the other side, sinister. Now, if you imagine this is a shield, a circular shield, held by an opponent, by an enemy, then, assuming the man to be right-handed, that's his nose and eyes peeking over the top, his right hand is opposite your own left hand. And this right-handed side of the shield held by the enemy facing you, in heraldry, is called the dexter side. And the other side is called the sinister side. Now the word sinister has gathered to itself various significances, all to do with darkness, obscurity, trickery, left-handedness, and so on. If we look at the word sin in it, we know this word sin is an old root meaning aim, but it means a private aim, and therefore an aim not identical with that of the absolute or of the universal. If we look at the word dexter, we see that it means the, or divided, or done externally. The ker root is the same as Torah or law. So the dexter side says it is the law of open doings. It is the extrovert side of a being. Those things that we do externally that we are not ashamed of or even socially delighted with, things we are proud of, we call dexter activities. And all the things that we have for private aims are called sinister, the law of the left, the law of the private aim. So we can write in the one circle the outer on the dexter side and the inner on the sinister side. Now if this were a shield in heraldry and a man and his wife were to blazon their symbols together on the same shield, the man would be placed on the dexter side and the woman would be placed on the sinister side. So that the one side is called home, where you keep the wife, and the other is out, where the husband goes into relation with other beings. Now, all the things that are socially called good are those that fulfill social ends. And therefore, we must define the word good to make sure we understand it. The root of good, or good, as they say in the Arab man, is the root gu, which is written G-U or G-O-O. Sometimes with a Scottish prefix, comes Magoo. This goo principle is the primary appetite of a substantially existing being. The hard G, the gamma or gimel, means gross material existence, and the U in it means power, going. So insofar as a being has a gross material body to refer to, and a certain amount of energy in that being pushing it along, that being is goo. Now if we use a little termination on the end of it, an ET, meaning little, and we put the glyph in for working out, and we say gullet, then gullet means a little goo at work. Goo means basic substantial appetite. And gullet, the name of the food pipe in a human being or in an animal, means a little goo. But the big goo is universal appetite itself, that which Shakespeare calls the universal wolf. Substantial going power, goo, is the same thing as will. You know, in French you would spell William with a G-U instead of a W. This is simply because if you pronounce a careless goo at the back prolonged, it tends to lapse into a W, like a oo. And if you pronounce a very hard oo in the throat, it will turn into goo. There's a relation between goo and woo. Now, in the word good, we have the principle of gross material and power going, travelling along. This is substantial appetite, and we have a letter symbolizing limit. limiting factor D means a door, and it means a line dividing one thing from another. So good means the will as far as it wills. It's going good. It's going willing along with its gross body, pushing in the experience of the world until it comes to a limiting factor at which limit it stops from itself and says, that is good. That is, I have willed so far and no further. We have to understand this fact before we can understand good or evil, right or wrong. Good means the will is going to a limit. It is willing so far and then stopping. It is willing and stopping from itself. That's good. It is not good if it would will through a situation and some other force acts upon it and stops it going as far as it would go if it could. So good means the will as far as it wills to go. And this means there is no good in the universe other than that willed by some being having this power of volition. When we oppose good and evil, we have to find out why. The word evil, Hebraica, is the reverse of live. In this case, good is the opposite of the opposite of live. So good is life. Life is good. And death is anti-good, in a sense. Why is this so? Because when the will is willing, if it is not imposed on by a force other than itself, it will will so far, it will will to a certain limit. This limit is D. When it gets there, it will stop. But if for any reason whatever it is not allowed to go as far as it wills to go, because of a superior force, then its good has been limited. And therefore, as its life is only its will, that is, the life is the will of a being functioning, then its life has been curtailed by another force. This force is an anti-life force, an anti-will force. In science recently they got fed up with gravity merely as a universal force, and they've got anti-gravity. They're having anti all sorts of forces these days because the old naive ideas of a material world are no longer working. You have a principle of determinism and a principle of anti-determinism. And then you have a principle of chance and a principle of anti-chance. And in the same way you have a principle of good and anti-good. Gravity, anti-gravity. This anti-thing has been occasioned by the failure of a merely materialistic hypothesis. Even an empirical scientist has a will which is pushing him along to experiment. And he considers it good if he gets as far as he's willing to go with his experiment. And anything that interferes with his experiment and curtails it, he calls not good. And because good is the life process of a will, and life is this will functioning, then anti-good is anti-life. And we write the word live, Hebraica, simply reverse the word, and it becomes evil. Now we want to see why the outer is called good and the inner is called anti-good by certain classes of beings and not by others, because we see this strange fact that dexter means exposed, shown, put your cards on the table. It appears that telling the truth openly is therefore supposed to be good. Let's write good on the dexter side. It is good to expose. And let's apply this principle to the story of Noah getting drunk in his tent and his son Ham coming in and discovering him drunk and naked and exposing his nakedness and going and telling his two brothers. Noah is very annoyed and curses his son for this and says it is not good. So Ham tends to expose, to show outwardly what is going on inside Noah's tent. And Noah means noetic principle, nous, intelligence. And it says, it is not good to expose certain things. It is good to expose other things. Now, if we remember that good means the will as far as it wills to go. That's good death. Therefore, if the will does not wish to go a certain distance, and another force comes from behind it and pushes it, and makes it go beyond the distance that it intends, that will has been exposed, that is, put out, exposed, put outside the limits of its own definition, which is then defined by the being suffering it as an evil, an anti-good, but by the being pushing it, is defined as a good. So we find that the concept of good and evil has to do with will, and it has to do with will pushing itself along in the gross material world, trying to establish itself. If there are two wills, there may be two goods. If the two wills happen to coincide exactly, then we will say there is one good for both of them, and that they coincide in willing this good. But if the two wills do not agree about how far to will, then in the struggle, each will define the other will as an anti-good, meaning anti-my will. Now, conscience means holding together that which has been cut. When we cut, we separate it, and we do so in order to clarify what is going on inside consciousness. If we write good on the outer side, and we say the outer and inner are opposites, we would have to write evil on the inner side, which is a very strange thing. Because when we come to write the center of initiative, we have to say that the inner is the center of initiative, and that is good. Initiative is good, and it starts within. Initiative is good and starts inside. On the other hand, the outside of a being is the part of the being subjected to external stimulation, and also the zone of the working of mass inertia, so that the outer must be evil. Now this shows that the good and the evil are relative to a defined aim, and that if you do not define your aim, you cannot legitimately claim that X is good or bad. Now let's consider the difference between ethics and morality. One is a Greek word and the other is a Roman Latin word. The Greek word ethics has to do with the way reasonable men decide it is reasonable to act. And moral means that which is convenient for the ruling of a material situation. The morale is that which is convenient for ruling a material situation, and the ethical is that which is considered by rational men to be the thing to do. So there's a slightly more elevated tone about the word ethics than there is about the word morals. Morals is an M word, and therefore signifies that which is low down, substantial, and more pertaining to women. And ethics is higher up and pertains more to men. Which is very strange, because if you analyze a society of human beings held together integrally by law, you find in nearly all civilizations that the law aims to protect woman, and the moral law particularly defends woman. That is, it defends the bearer of the child that guarantees the continuation of society. Woman has to be protected if she is a childbearer. If she's not, it's a matter of no account. But if she is, then society, to preserve itself, must protect the mother principle. So we find the MO principle in moral and the MO principle in mother. This means a substantial zone, a zone where substance has the superstress. Substance is paramount. Substance is important, the MO principle. You know, it's the Hebraica, it's the great word of the yogis, Om, which simply means all substance whatever. When we utter the mystical word Om, we are supposed to say we are experiencing in the frequent vibrations of our bodies by their overlappings, the various frequencies, we are experiencing the totality of all substantial vibrations within the field of our consciousness. This is the meaning of the Om. If you feel the body as a sort of sounding board or resonator for cosmic motion, then what you are experiencing is the significance of Om. And there the zone is mentioned first. It says a zone of substance, O-M. In the other case, it is not the zone that is important, but the substance. We say MO, the mother principle. MO and THER, or MOTR, the substance zone law, is the name mother. Mother means the zone where the law of substance is operating. So that the moral law essentially protects the substance principle. Society has a moral law in order to protect substance, the substance of the human race, protoplasm, and the new protoplasm that is going to appear and express itself as the next generation is coming from the mother, born by the mother, nourished by the mother, and the father principle is simply the trigger that allows this to receive a certain amount of formal initiative, a certain amount of formal impetus before it starts its new level of evolution. It is usual to write the mother principle on the sinister side, and we see immediately we'd be in trouble again if we said that sinister means evil, because it would mean your mother is no good. And on the other side, we would have to write the principle of father, pa, and we change the O to R in pa, because the letter R means energy rising up, that is transcending. The letter O means binding, circumscribing, limiting. Letter R means energy transcending. So pa is the same thing as point to transcendent energy, and mo means substantial zone or circumscribed substance. If we said the mo is an evil principle, we would say pa is a good principle. Now, mothers and fathers have been battling for thousands of years, and there have been great battles between matriarchies and patriarchies. They're called mokriarchies and patriarchies. And because they have fought, each one has defined its own side as good. But it has not said that good means for the fulfillment of my will. And if we remember that good means the will up to the limit it chooses to act, then any being is quite legitimate within the law of its own being to define what it is doing as far as it wills to do it as a good for it, because good only means in accordance with the limiting factors imposed on the will by itself. In this sense, the question of what is good and evil within the finite realm, under analysis, is always relative to the purpose or the will of the being defining it. Now, when we come to look at the meaning of the word dexter, we find a synonym for dexter is right. This is the right side of the shield. So we'll write the word right on the dexter side, and the opposite of right is wrong. Now we see that a group of beings have been defining the dexter as the pa or father side, the right side, the good side, and the dexter. And another group have been saying, in opposition to this, that the sinister side, the mother side, the substance side, is not evil and is not wrong and is in fact a good, a life principle. This is just mother and father arguing about the respective merits of their functions. Mothers receive and fathers put in. Father feels smart when he's putting in, and mother feels smart when she's persuaded him to put in. And according to their definitions, they each feel that they are doing good. This is why we have to beware of do-gooders, because in fact they're only doing what they will to do as far as they will to do it. And we have to make quite sure that their will coincides with ours if we want their good to be coincident with ours. Now, heraldry, unfortunately for woman, was invented by man, and therefore we find a peculiar thing. Because it was invented by man, we find the general tendency is to define and to accept as accurately defined that the dexter side of the shield is father's side, is the good side, is the right side, is outer, open, decent, honourable, and prepared to show itself. And the mother side is evil, is wrong, is bent, is twisted, lacks initiative, and in fact is full of negative qualities. This is the definition made by man. And this is a historical fact. He has made the definitions. Woman did not make these definitions because, not being stressed on the intellect, which is the machine that makes definitions, she just didn't get round to it. So she's presented with a series of definitions, affirmed, posited, put forth with a sense of absolute right with them, from the male. Now the funny thing about it is this: the male is completely right to define in this way, because he's a male. He must define substance as an evil to himself, because substance is the principle of inertia. He must define it as wrong for him, because it is inertic and therefore cannot initiate. He must define it as an evil because it is against his own life, because his own life is expansive and continuously pursuing transcendence of any established form. His life is empty routine. Therefore the whole life of the male is concerned with itself, and all its definitions are definitions to extend its own will, its own good. And as women don't know how to define, unless they've been listening in men's secret conversations or keyholes, or even in bed when he's talking in his sleep, they have not managed to produce a system intellectually as coherent as that produced by men. Now, because every act of a will tends to define, to circumscribe itself, or as we would say in our chemical psychological terminology, every spirit seeks a body, then every will embodying itself defines accurately or vaguely, accurately for man and vaguely for woman, defines itself as a good thing. And in the process it tends, when it has defined something as a good, that simply means the will has gone into it to a certain limit. And in the process, because will is energy, is sentient power, in going into it, it has in fact embodied nothing but self-witness. It is a will witnessing itself. And this is the meaning of the word ego, of the Latins, of the ahamkara of the yogis, the I-making substance. Because the will is going in there, it is a self-witnessing will, but every force going into a closed system becomes inertic. And this means to say that every male force making a definition for itself to a certain limit has, in the act of completing its definition, turned into a woman. It has imposed upon itself by the inertia of its own definition. If it now rests within the definition, it falls asleep. And this tendency to fall asleep has to be offset by another being who is chemically inhibited from making accurate definitions within itself, and this being is woman. It is the function of this woman to prod this self-defined male and force him to redefine the situation, otherwise he will become an entirely closed and isolated system. In other words, he will feminize if he is not provoked. This tendency to feminize by defining and accepting definitions imposing upon oneself is most marked in the feminine contours and responses of the average university professor or the university don. They have evidences within them that their definitions of themselves and their definitions of their own attainment and cleverness feminize them. They become self-satisfied. They turn upon their own substance, feed within their substance, and they are fed by the concepts. And the stimuli come from outside are the masculine elements coming inside, and they are absorbing those stimuli as if they were women. So that these people respond to an external stimulus and absorb it and take it to a process of gestation exactly analogous to that of a woman being impregnated, giving birth to a child. We see that the good and the evil depend entirely upon who is defining them. That the right and the wrong also depend on the same thing. Outer and inner depend on the same thing. When we examine very carefully the patriarchs and their definitions, the great old Hebrew patriarchs and the Roman patriarchs, we find a peculiar thing about them. They taught that it was very, very good to be open, that it was masculine to be honest and show your muscles. And they go about not shaking hands in a limp manner, shaking firmly each other's forearms to test muscle power, to know whether to disagree on them. They teach openness and say, put all your cards on the table, that is manly. But if we read the history of these men who are recommending openness, we find they're all busy cutting each other's throats in the middle of the night. We find all the people who taught openness and decency and rationality and ethics, in fact, murdering each other on every conceivable occasion, in the dark, sub rosa, and usually with the aid of women as decoy ducks. So that the reason why these definitions have been made, why that which is shown is good and that which is hidden is evil, is simply because certain beings will to be on the right side. They will everybody else to expose their cards. Now, we have a definition of the church as the left arm of the state and the military as the right arm. So we'd have to write the army on the dexter side and the church on the sinister side. Now, if we accept in this initial definition, dexter is right, is good, and patriarchal, and sinister is matriarchal and evil and wrong, then the army would be right and the church would be wrong. What we have to remember is that this circle represents the totality of knowledge of a being at a given cross-section of its life, and it is cut into half. And that this cut is an abstract idea. It corresponds with nothing whatever, existentially. It is an intellectual activity to pretend you can cut it. And therefore, the wholeness of the being, the calm altogetherness of it, has not been destroyed by this intellectual abstract action pretending to cut it. And therefore, we say, there is a father and a mother in every being. There is a male-female aspect of every being. There is a good and evil in every being. There is an outer and an inner, and there is right and there is wrong in every being. But the right and the wrong are so by definition only. Therefore, we can say that the head says the belly is wrong, the belly says that the head is wrong, and they both fight on the battlefield of the feeling in the heart zone, and the battlefield is no man's zone. So that until a being wholly comes to terms with himself, he will never be sure about what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong, what is power and what is moral. What you want to find is an absolute good and see if there is an absolute evil. It may be that the opposition good and evil is not horizontal. And if you were to put a bar and write on one side good and on the other side evil, as if there were a pair of scales here with a balance, perhaps the opposition good and evil isn't like that at all. Perhaps it is a different kind of opposition. The opposition between the absolutely right and the relatively wrong. We've seen this problem raised many times in philosophy. All the theologians admit that God is absolutely right, but the dualist thinks that the devil is as right as God is. So that would make two absolutes. And the absolute, in being defined, eliminates the concept of duality. So that either God or the devil is not absolute. And here again, it's entirely a matter of definition. And for what purpose, whether you say God is good and the devil is evil, or the devil is good and God is evil. Let's draw again a circle, close it. We've now got a circumscribed or isolated zone. Mentally rub it out, now it's gone. Supposing we never draw one, supposing God never creates at all, he never circumscribes, never finites, never brings any creature to be. But if he doesn't, he has not guled his own being. He has not willed to any limit. And he then remains in his absoluteness, where absolute means when all formal contingencies or whatever are washed away. When all phenomena are absolved, washed away, then God is in his absoluteness. But in that absoluteness, there is no finite, there is no creature, there is no good. There is no willing to a limit because there is no limit. And therefore the absolute God is no good. Now who said so? Well, obviously, The already defined being said so. And the already defined being is called the devil. And some say the devil is bad. Who says so? People that want to identify with the good. Let's write devil inside here. Let's write some slightly different spelling as used by Hobbes in his book Leviathan Divil. Now, Div is the name God, and Dev is the name God, and El is the name God, and Il is the name God. So the Divil means the God in two aspects. First, the God El, which means the absolute worker, first worker, A-L, E-L, and Div means the principle of division, or the principle of feared or analyzed vision. Videre to see, and Div is root in divide. God as divider of one being from another is the creator. But as divider of one being from another, he is the devil. That he is a finiting principle separating one person from another. So that when Jesus comes along and starts separating, or as they say today, sorting out the rabbis, when he starts sorting them out, they say, behold, he has a devil. And if you see a little boy tearing your favourite tape recorder to bits, you say, he's a bit of a devil. Meaning he's tearing the thing to bits. The function of isolating and separating beings is the function of the devil. Now, is this devil good or bad? Well, that depends whether your will is willing to take it to bits or willing to keep it together. If your will is taking it to bits, you call it an analytical exercise. If your will is trying to put the bits together, he calls it an exercise in resisting the forces of disintegration. It is impossible to say without defining the purpose and from whose side whether a thing is good or evil. If we write devil within the circumscription, then beyond it we must say it's God. And that God beyond is the absolute God, beyond definition. But also, it is said, God created. So one has put God inside the circle as the author of creation. But this God as author of creation, author of finite or limited beings, is the devil. And the God beyond this finiting is the devil, because he continuously threatens the already existent with dissolution. We find people afraid of existence, and we find them afraid of the void. Those who are afraid of daily life and its pressures think that daily life plays the devil with them. And yet, very often they don't commit suicide because they're afraid, like Hamlet, of the things that might exist after death. They have a fear of the void. Devil and God can be written equally legitimately outside and inside the circle. Conscience simply means the totality of your knowledge insofar as you can get hold of it in a given cross-section of time where you find yourself standing. It is a whole assumed to be cut into parts, and the assumption of the cutting into parts is an intellectual act which has no essential, substantial validity whatever. It is entirely an arbitrary definition. When we consider any finite purpose at all, and that means they're all practical, pira act all on rational purposes, the rational pira act, you see, the practical, for practical purposes, the finite is a good. Nobody ever saw a man yet that had a practical purpose that he didn't think was good, meaning to say he was willing to a certain limit. And that limit is the D. But that D is the perimeter of the circle that begins at a point P and the radius R. So pi ratio determines the function of finiting and of creation and of the good of the finite order. We want an absolute good. How can we find it when we've already seen that these things are all relative? And the answer is a very simple one. Simply affirm that all the definitions are as good as all the other definitions. This is an absolute good. This is a method of converting the relative into the absolute. This is what Jesus does. He says, whatever you call good and evil, you don't know what you're talking about. From whose point of view are you saying it? When you tread on the worm, do you call it good? Does the worm like it? Instead of that, let us say that those functions of the absolute will, and the absolute cannot be hindered at the absolute level, those functions of the absolute will are called absolute good. Those functions of the relative finite will are relative finite good. Some people called strongly developed egoic personalities can, in the place of their own being, refute the absolute good. That is to say, they can behave inefficiently, they can get out of relation with other beings, they can fail, they can beat their heads against the wall, all, remember, willing to do so, and therefore calling it good. And yet, because they are finite, they cannot win in the battle against the absolute, which is infinite. So we see, while finite beings call their own function good, another kind of consciousness can say these are only relative goods, and the absolute good is the absolute tolerance of all conceivable goods, including all the relative ones as well as the absolute. This would make tolerance of every conceivable purpose in the time process for finite individuals, and raise the problem for given individuals at a certain level about whether this is a good thing to do. Supposing we remove all the chains from all the criminals and let them loose. Is that a good thing? Well, if we remember that good is as far as we will to go, well, we're talking abstractly if we say, let us suppose that we release all the prisoners from the world's jails and let them loose. What's going to happen? We know what's going to happen if we release them. They'll start fending for themselves very vigorously like they did before they were locked up. And therefore, society, that is, beings at other levels, at inertic levels of awareness, will not let them out. This is an existential fact. If you say, worrying, if we let them all out, it will be awful, or what will happen? The answer is, they're not going to be let out, because there are an awful lot of beings that are inertic who won't let them out. So the few who are not inertic begin to understand the opposition in the definition, don't need to worry about locking up all these criminals, because the inertic people will lock them up. This is what Jesus said by let the dead bury their dead. Don't worry about the dead, he says, the dead will bury. Don't worry about the criminals being locked up, the other criminals will lock them up. This is what he means by it. All those people who are finite and egotistic will stop all the other finite and egotistic people from interfering too much. So as soon as we start to multiply these zones of individuated or egoic activity, we find that a natural tendency to a kind of dynamic equilibrium occurs in the continuous struggling of egocentric beings, each one to keep its own end. Now, from above the absolute, he's seeing that this struggle is going on, and he is pressing one down there and lifting another up here. Or as he says, I will lay the mountains low and exalt the valleys. He is maintaining a dynamic equilibrium of the private purposes of all egocentric beings. And this is the absolute good. That he equilibrates all the private aims, all the errors, all the wrongs, which are all relative goods to the individual pursuing them. But they're wrongs insofar as they're private, privated or deprived of absolute awareness. The absolute good is the good of the absolute. And the absolute good is the good it equilibrates all relative goods. So we can have our relative good and evil at the level of the finite and particularized, and at the same time we can see that there is another kind of good, which is a very efficient good, because it utilizes all the selfishness of the finite and ego centers by bringing them into relation with each other in such ways that they contradict each other's intent to dominate the universe. So we see that although good and evil are relative, they are relative only at the finite end. But at the infinite end, they are subject to an absolute good. And the absolute good is defined by the finite, private, egocentric as an idiom. And correctly so, because the absolute good will defeat all the finite private purposes. When William Blake's invitation is given to God, he should let God come into a circle and see how he goes on. That's an egocentric artist, challenging God to do as well as he can do, under the circumstances. So we can have our relative good and evil at the level of the finite and particularized, and at the same time we can see that there is another kind of good, which is a very efficient good, because it utilizes all the selfishness of the finite ego centers by bringing them into relation with each other in such ways that they contradict each other's intent to dominate the universe. So we see that although good and evil are relative, they are relative only at the finite end. But at the infinite end, they are subject to an absolute good. And the absolute good is defined by the finite, private, egocentric as an evil. And correctly so, because the absolute good will defeat all the finite, private purposes. When William Blake's invitation is given to God, he says, let God come into a circle and see how he goes on. That's an egocentric artist, challenging God to do as well as he can do, under the circumstances. And Blake knows what he means, because he is God in the position of Blake. And he knows this because there is nothing other than God. That a private being, a private, finite, limited being, has no reality whatever of its own. It is a modality of the motion of the absolute. And as such, it is the absolute modalizing itself in that peculiar way. So as a Blake or a Shakespeare or a Beethoven kind of say, I am God in my place. And he is God, which is the same thing as he is good, God is good. We leave out the double O, we put one O in instead of two, and we turn about O into O when we say, the being, the will, is now ensphering itself perfectly than the God, as opposed to the good. God is the complete expression of the good. That God is the term of the will. In any being, when that being wills to a perfect form for itself, has completely ensphered in existence its will, it is a God. But it's not the God, and it's not the absolute. It is simply a God. Therefore it says in the Old Testament, is it not written, ye are gods. Christ quotes this statement, ye are gods. Meaning, you have the potential of defining the sphere of being and activity of yourself, and insofar as you can adequately define the sphere of your own activities, you are gods, but you are little gods. But the absolute God, called the Godhead or the God, is not finite at all. It is this absolute infinite God that has the whip hand of all the other gods, because he happens to be the infinite field, the modalities of which constitute the other finite ones. So he cannot be defeated, because the energy used to defeat him is his own energy. And therefore he is permitting any revolt that breaks out in any zone, and he's allowing it to go so far and no further. And he stops it by bringing into relation with it other beings likewise ambitious, but in a contradictory manner. So there are people we call levelers or democrats, who say that all men are born exactly the same height, weight, color, and so on. These levelers, if they were to win, would reduce everybody to a sort of gingerbread man shape and with the same function. But there are some other people, the hierarchy men, who believe that the level is merely an abstract idea. God brings the levelers and the hierarchs together and lets them fight it out. But he never lets one of them win. Because if he did, then that one would be on the top. But that is not possible for the finite, the absolute inhibited. And nevertheless, there's a greater truth in the hierarchy than there is in the leveler, dynamically. You see, the leveler is your mother, but the hierarchy is your father. Nice little word there. Now, substance is the principle of closure and of inertia, of non-action, of simple being. But the positing or initiating function of the male is the disturber of that equilibrium. Now, if there were no equilibrium to disturb, then the P could not function. There must be an M for the P to function on. But in terms of value, because value means good, and that means willing to a certain limit, and the principle of will is the principle of initiative, then the principle of initiative is male, and the male is the source of the hierarchy, that is, of the differentiating factors that distinguish one being from another. So although in a certain sense they are equal and opposite, their opposition is not on the same level, because the P function is from above and the M function is from below, unless you care to turn it down the other way. Now, everybody that we know, every human being that we know, worships, that is to say, continuously remembers or tries to attain or to possess the principle of life. And the principle of life they feel to be energy or force applied intelligently. Everybody is worshipping this. They prefer action, intelligence, and energy. But these are all things to do with initiative and to do with the male element. So not only do men worship men, but women worship men too. Only there's a slight difference between the two kinds of worship. The man who worships himself as an energy principle is all right, because he's worshipping the universal in the particular. But if he worships himself as a finite individual with a definite amount of force which he has captured for himself, already he has become a woman. In order to remain a man, he must keep in contact with this absolute, this infinite, this initiating force. This is the meaning of the statement: God, man, woman. The orders go that way, from the infinite through the initiating finite into the inertic substance. If men refuse to do this for any misguided levelist view, all that will happen is that women will start doing it. In other words, everybody will turn upside down, and the beings now called women will become men, and the beings now called men will become women. Every living being is worshipping the principle of initiative, of energy, of the cause of change, of power to differentiate, power to produce new values. So that in principle everybody is worshipping the male, the function that produces these substantial differentiations. And a woman, as opposed to a man, is blazing, as we saw before, on the sinister side of the shield. And therefore, although she worships the man, she has a secret intent not to let him know that, in case he becomes top heavy. And we know that the man is a dexter being. He likes to show out his powers, because where he's powerful, he'd like to show off, and he'd like to rule the situation. Also, he'd like other people to see his powers, but he'd like other people to show their cards so that he can adjust his powers and remain on top. So that men tend to boast, and boys tend to wrestle and push each other about. But women, being on the sinister side, the obscure side, the canting or bent side, try to keep from men the secret worship, except on very special occasions, such as the special occasion when a woman is trying to get hold of a man for her purpose. When she does this, she's prepared to admit that she thinks he's a marvelous fellow. She's doing this because she sees potentialities in him for the fulfillment of her purpose. But insofar as she has a purpose, she's a man. So we see that if a woman has a clearly defined purpose, the part of her that can clearly define this is male. And if a man can be captured by the stimulation of the completed definition, that is, if he can be caught into believing himself such and such a definable being, he has become a man. Now we see here all the time the continuous passing in both directions, from the sinister to the dexter side, from the dexter to the sinister. we see that the passage of energies from the head down to the belly, an attempt to inhibit it, and of the energies from the belly up to the head to empower it. These things are going on all the time. It's a reciprocal two-way flow, and this is life. Nevertheless, we have to recognize that the principle of good, by the beings that define it, has to do with will, with initiative, and with knowing how to define it. That's gu, the initiative, the will, grossly substantiated, and d, the limit defined, to which it will work. And that all human beings are worshipping this principle of definition in the world. Power and definition, these two, they worship them. If we write down here M for the will, the more principle or appetite, and P for the idea, then the completed being must be PM or MP. But this is the same thing as being a hermaphrodite, a male female. And you remember that Jesus and all the great religious teachers talk about this fusion of the two aspects of being, but not the fusion to the point of loss of one in the other, but the fusion in the sense of functional interrelation of the idea with the will. The P represents the idea positive, and the M represents the appetite that will empower it. And a being that can balance these two functions within himself is called a divine hermaphrodite, or, if we write the names for it, we find in our chemical tract, he is vir, or male, and yin, or female. He is a virgin. Virgin means male and female. It means ideas, triumphing ideas. To triumph by publishing differences is vir. This is the word sonship into the word hero. Yin is the word you find in gynecology, the science of the way women tick, and corresponds with the sexual principle of the belly, which is absorbing the form from above. The human being who becomes aware that he has these two aspects is called a male hermaphrodite. He is a virgin, but it's virgin, virgin, not gin vir. The thing that is mentioned first because it's most important. It is most important because import means carry in, and what is carried in is the will. And the whole movement of the universal sentient power is to precipitate form and energize it. Every spirit seeks a formal expression, and therefore the absolute Mare, or M principle, cosmic ocean, is moving always towards formal creation. So that the ultimate aim of all movement of spirit is the creation of the virgin, or male-female, with a stress on the vir, or formative triumphing principle. It isn't enough just to be for a human being. One must be dynamic, one must be consciously creative. And to do this, one must become clear about the nature of thought, the nature of reason, the nature of right and wrong, of good and evil, of high, low, right and left, and so on. When these things are clarified, it becomes apparent that in the process of clarification, one's initiative relative to other beings has been raised to a higher level. Other beings are then becoming progressively more negative and more female. Thus, a woman who knows not more than another woman, if she is giving advice to that other woman, is acting the man with that woman. A woman who tries to talk to herself and overthrow a mere mood, an undefined emotional state in herself, by reasonably talking to herself about its causes, is acting like a virgin, that is, as a male or female. A woman that actually listens to what she's saying when she does this and then acts upon it is an attained virgin. She can actually talk to herself and listen and put it into action. But this is the same thing as being released from the necessity of the external stimulus. And this is the ultimate goal of the reset being, that it must become a self-stimulating, self-initiating, free center of consciousness.
Would the universe constitute the conscious of the absolute?
By universe, you mean the totality of form, don't you? Not just universe in the astronomical sense.
No.
Yeah. The totality of all conceivable form is the consciousness of God. Well, this is the meaning of the Logos again. The great principle of the rationale of all being. But it does not go beyond the big circumscription. Beyond that, there is the infinite. And the infinite is not part of God's consciousness. That's God's initiative that operates and creates the consciousness.
But the consciousness has a value insofar as
you will it. Mm-hmm. Remember, value means will. V-A-L and V-O-R are the same thing. So the value exists only because you will it. The totality of your knowledge is value because you will to use it. It's more than you will to throw it away. Now it has no value. Can you live without it? Answer yes, by immediate awareness. Don't worry about the past. You know, something very peculiar about this. We draw a line to represent the time process and events upon this line. The tendency of Epimetheus Prometheus, the afterthinker and forethinker, is to believe that he derives information by running along this line and having a temporal experience, one after the other, a series of experiences, and that by a process of summation and relation he builds a conscience. But if he is doing so, he must be doing a very peculiar thing, because he's still got these experiences with him. So he must be involving into the sphere of his being experiences and relating them together in some pattern. So every time he adds another experience, he alters the geometry of his form. And if he places them correctly in pairs of opposites, he will ultimately become a spherical being in the time process. But in fact, this is not what he's doing, and he couldn't do this at all if the reality were as he thinks it is. What's really happening is that this time process, as we know perfectly well by the case of the earth going around the sun, there's the sun and the radiation, there's the earth going around, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, etc., of the earth are different places in the earth. All the experiences are spatially laid out. They're part of the geometry of the solar system. And this solar system is part of the geometry of the sidereal system. The whole formal system itself is a great sphere, the sophical wisdom sphere. All that is happening in the time process is that one is becoming aware that forces are entering in at right angles to the time process. The stimulus in the time merely reminds us of some of the geometrical potentialities of our being. When a stimulus hits us, what it's actually hitting, represented properly, is an egg. A human being is a developed egg. The stimulus hits it, and it merely supersesses an already existing pattern within the egg, because the egg is dynamic. The egg is vibrating. So if we said the pattern of vibrations within the egg can be reduced to a very simple diagram in the double triangle or six-pointed star. We say that's just a shorthand form of the vibrational content of the egg. The egg is a sphere. The sphere contains all the possibilities of all spheres, whatever. So that when a stimulus comes to it, the stimulus itself is a definite amount of energy coming from a source, that is, from a point in geometrical space. It merely resonates within this finite being, and forces that being to become aware of some of its geometrical possibilities. So that in fact the temporal stimulus is merely causing us to become aware of the geometrical structure of eternity. This eternal sphere, the Sophic sphere, the sphere of Sophia, of wisdom, is simply the internal geometry of any sphere whatever. A sphere which is a continuum, a substance which is pure dynamism and passless, must exhaust the geometrical possibilities of all spheres. Therefore, every egg that is sentient, every living being from an egg developed, is in fact as wise as any other being. This is the leveling principle. in its absolute level. But in the temporal level and existentially, we do find, in fact, that stimuli in the time process have provoked different people to become aware of different aspects of the totality of being. So we have a hierarchy in the time process. Although eternally, all spheres are equal. So the time is the period of the expression of the hierarchy of values, and eternity is the assumed substratum and ground of democratic theory. If we like to think about it, that the original protoplasm, or first modelable substance of the infinite, is the Adam Kadmon, as the Kabbalists, or the supreme cosmic man. And we think about it as a great amoeba, and it distorts itself and pushes out a limb here, and a limb here, and another limb here, and so on. In biological terms, we would call one of those a pseudopodium, a false foot. In this sense, every individual human being is a pseudopodium of God. He's simply a little extension of the energy of the infinite sentient power in the time process. It is possible for the energy in a pseudopodium to move out quite a long way, but if it hasn't got a nucleus in its intelligence, it can't break off and become a being on its own. It has to contract and return to center. In the same way, any individual who has no center of reference in himself can never sever himself from the central intelligence. But in the infinite sense, because there is no escape from infinity by a finite, because the finite is within the infinite, no finite can ever escape the intelligence of the absolute. Therefore, he cannot be cut off. And as the state of hell and sin is said to be a state of cut-offness from God, but this cut-offness is merely a convenience of definition by the intellect, then no person can ever be cut off in any real sense from what religion is called salvation. The idea of being cut off is an illusion. It cannot be an essential fact. Therefore, no human being is lost. Therefore, no human being needs saving. What he needs is getting rid of the erroneous idea that he needs saving and is lost. But getting rid of this erroneous idea is the same thing in practical terms as being saved. That the salvation is only the elimination of an erroneous idea that had no correspondence in fact.